Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Affinity Finance podcast. I'm Lauren Ashen, Client Relationship Manager at Affinity Finance, and today I'm with Tom Carter from Ropeport Chambers. We will be discussing everything around procedure, settlement and costs for Japanese knotweed claims. Welcome back, Tom.
Hi, Lauren.
Tom, what are the first things you should think about when we have a new case?
The first thing is thinking about what kind of case is it and who are the defendants. So you've got the nuisance claims, which we've talked about so far. You may also have claim against the seller if they've recently bought it, so a misrepresentation claim, or possibly a professional negligence claim against their surveyor or possibly their conveyancers. I know we'll talk about those kind of claims in a later podcast, but that's one thing to think about first is what kind of claims might there be, because there might be more than just a nuisance claim. Sticking with nuisance claims, again, if it's obvious who the defendant's likely to be, so taking, say, like a Network Rail type case as an example, you've got long railway line, that's where the mature Japanese knotweed is. That may be fine. If you've got multiple neighbours and it's slightly unclear, then that's going to be something that you'll have to deal with in expert evidence, but you need to identify who the defendants might be. Again, then also, one of the things I think is really important to get early on, and again, I know we've spoken about this, but this is really important to emphasise, is get the evidence together, particularly photographs, ask the client what they have, but if they don't have any, or even if they have taken them, get the client from day one to be keeping basically a photo diary of taking photographs once a week, if not once a fortnight, of the knotweed during the growing season, so that if you're still dealing with the case in a year's time, 2 years' time, you can track what's happened with the knotweed. And that might not be important necessarily to begin with, but if defendant puts in place treatment or has just started treatment when you take the case on, then it might be really important in a year or two. If you're able to demonstrate what effect it's had, it may not have had any effect at all, in which case that's going to be really important. Another thing also to think about is witnesses. You've got your own client as the obvious witness. Also, if they have recently purchased the property, as well as thinking about possible claims against the seller for misrepresentation, if you decide for whatever reason there might not be a viable claim there, or maybe the seller just is unlikely to have any assets, so you think, well, it's not worth pursuing them, whatever it may be, it might be worthwhile thinking, well, can the seller actually help with a claim against the defendant if it's a nuisance claim? So if the claimant's only bought the house within, say, the last 2 years, they might not be able to help with the history of the knotweed, but you might find the seller actually can help with how long's it been there, when did it spread, even if they didn't know it was knotweed, how long have they recognised it growing in the garden, even if they didn't know what it was. So that might be helpful. As well as the seller, you've got neighbours as well. So identifying early on, are there any neighbours who know anything about it? A, in terms of the history of the knotweed, but also, again, they might be able to talk about whether they reported it to the defendant. If it's a large body of knotweed, might be spreading to multiple houses. So it might be really helpful early on, and it's useful if possible to have this before sending the letter of claim to say, well, the claimant didn't report it till 2015, but actually number 30 next door reported it in 2012. So really the things, Lauren, I think are important to try and get early on are get all the evidence the client has, photographs, get them taking photographs as well, thinking ahead to the future, identify any other witnesses, whether that is the seller, whether it's neighbours, try and find out from them how long the knotweed's been there, when it's spread to the claimant's property, and also whether they reported it, and if so, when they reported it. So those are all, I think, really useful things to try and get.
Is it possible then to do a rough valuation of a claim before you have expert evidence?
Yeah, usually you can, and it can be important because in these kinds of claims, you've got one issue is liability of the claim, as with any claim. That's fine, and you can assess that, and you might need the expert evidence. But another point which can often come up, and it doesn't really affect higher value properties, but if you've got a lower value, 150,000 or less, maybe up to 200,000, then it can be important to know whether you're likely to get over the small claims threshold of £10,000. If you have a case where you can fairly set out your claim at, let's say, 15,000, and you go to a trial, let's say 2 day trial, and at the end of the claim you win, but you only get 7,000, 8,000 in damages. There's a perfectly fair argument that in that situation, you should normally get your costs as you would have done because you've been allocated to fast track or multi track. You've had a fight about it, unless the defendants protected themselves with a part 36, in which case they'd get their costs anyway if they made a part 36 higher than the damages. Then normally you could fairly expect the court to say, well, we've been allocated, going to award you costs on the normal hourly rate basis. But if you can't actually fairly put your claim at a value of over 10,000, then the risk is you run it all the way to a trial and then you're only going to recover small claims costs, which won't cover majority of the disbursements. They also won't cover large amounts of your costs, so it's not worthwhile to run. So I do think it is important to have a rough and ready valuation early on. And it is usually possible to do that in a fairly rough and ready way without the surveyor's report, because you don't always want to spend hundreds of pounds on a surveyor just to say, no, sorry, not going to be high enough value. My approach normally when looking at them as a rule of thumb is, if the clients purchased the property recently, what did they purchase it for? Take that as the rough value and then think about 5%-ish for diminution. Surveyor may give you more than that, but that's a good rough and ready approach. For diminution alone, then, that means anything worth 200,000 or more would get you the 10,000 5%. If it's less than that, you need to be thinking about the other heads of loss and whether they're sustainable. You've got treatment as well. Normally treatment, again, maybe more, but as a rough and ready figure, you can assume normally ends up being, in my experience, 3,600. That's 3,000 plus VAT. If you have a case with fairly recent encroachment after, say, 2013, and you can probably establish the defendant should have known about it and stopped it encroaching, then you can recover your treatment costs. It's a type one type case that we spoke about in, I think, even the first podcast. If the encroachment's historic, so if your client says, well, I've been living there 20 years and it's always been there, even if I didn't know what it was, then you're probably a type two case and you're not going to establish damages for treatment. Instead, you'll just have damages for diminution in value. Then you need to be thinking about, are you likely to recover treatment? So if it's a type one type case with recent encroachment and you have a property worth, say, 150,000, that's not going to get you the 10,000 on its own. But if you add 3,600 for treatment, you may well be over or close. And then you've got general damages as well, which are normally more modest. But if you assume a sort of rough and ready figure of £200 per year, and you can take that from date of knowledge until either when you have your instructions or until when they started treating, if that's already in place. So let's say you've got two claimants, so they're each getting £200 a year for 5 years. That's what, £400 times five, that's 2,000. So you can do a rough and ready calculation like that, basically to say 5% diminution in value. Is there likely to be treatment costs or not? If so, add 3,600. If not, then you shouldn't. And then add something for general damages. If you're well over 10,000, then you should be fine. If you're on the boundary, then it might be one to get advice on, or you might want to take a risk and pay a surveyor to give you a report, but accepting there's a chance they may come back with figures that don't get you over. If you have, let's say, a house worth 100,000, there's been encroachment 20 years ago, so you know you're not going to recover treatment costs. You're only looking at diminution in value. The reality is you're probably not going to get the 10,000. So you can't really present your claim over 10,000 in a way that you think you'd get your costs. So that's why it's important. Effectively, at 5% plus 3,600 if treatment, plus something for general damages. And also, of course, if you've got damage to patio, shed, fence. That's really how I would say you should look at it to decide whether or not you actually want to pay a surveyor to do a full report.
Brilliant. That makes complete sense. Thank you so much for that. What evidence should you have in place before you issue a claim then?
Before you issue, you really need the expert evidence. You need a report from your knotweed expert. And it may be that you've got that earlier on. So thinking about the valuation point we were just talking about, it may be that you get the knotweed report early, but then you decide to wait a little bit until you get the surveyor's report. That's fine, because you might want to wait until you know you have a viable claim with a report from the knotweed expert. But you do need then also the surveyor's expert before you issue. Firstly, if you don't have it, it's very difficult to value the claim. Secondly, sometimes you might have an initial report from somebody, or depending on when you've taken on the case, if you've instructed an expert who actually isn't going to be reliable, I know we've spoken about that in previous podcasts, then you really want to be getting a report from a reliable expert before you issue, because what you don't want is issue, serve, defendant says, well, we don't want you to have permission for another expert, and then you're having to have a fight at CMC stage about whether you should have permission for a different expert. So you need the expert evidence, knotweed expert report and surveyor's report on diminution in value. If you're also claiming damage to a wall or a fence shed, you need really that in place before you issue. You can get an updated quote later, but you do need it in place to actually value the claim. And then also you need to know what your case actually is to properly plead the claim. But in terms of the lay evidence that I think you really need as a minimum, you need the evidence of when the claimant or somebody else reported it. And if it was in writing, ideally to have a copy of that, because you don't want to plead your claim in very vague terms and then not really know what your case is on when they reported it, because it might be really important whether they reported in 2010 or 2013. That difference might be important. You also want, ideally, to know that any other witnesses, neighbours, sellers are going to actually cooperate. We've all seen cases where you have a very informal letter from a neighbour saying, I told them about it then and I did this. And then when push comes to shove, they refuse to sign a witness statement. If they sign a signed witness statement, if they then later didn't want to attend trial, well, you can, if push comes to shove, look to witness summons them. But it's very difficult to witness summon somebody if they haven't provided a witness statement, because then you don't actually know what their evidence should be. So again, if you've got potentially evidence from neighbour or sellers, you really should try and get a witness statement signed with a statement of truth from them before you issue. Doesn't mean you can't amend it later, but if they don't then later cooperate, you have that. And those really, I think, are the crucial points. When it was reported, signed statements from neighbours, and also the expert evidence. If you've got those, you can issue and serve. You know what your case is going to be. And then depending on what the defendant says in their defence, of course, you can look to have further expert evidence later. And it may be if the defendant gets their own expert, there's going to be a joint report anyway. That's all fine. But those really are the bare minimum things that I would say to anybody. I don't think it's a good idea to issue unless you have those already.
Thanks, Tom. You know how we've spoken before about properties that, or claimants that are on the same street or same road? If you did have multiple claimants, should you issue these claims separately, or is it a good idea to issue them all together?
Can be a tricky one. Sometimes you have a row of houses. I've seen this where three of five of them use one firm, the other two use a different firm. Clearly, you can only really coordinate the claimants that you're dealing with. But let's just assume all of them have instructed you. As a general rule, if it raises the same kind of issue, so again, if you think about a Network Rail case as an obvious example, they're all backing onto a railway line. They're all affected by the same body of knotweed that's spreading into all of their back gardens. The reality is, if you issue them separately, you may well find the courts looking to consolidate them all anyway, because you're probably not going to have, say, five different trials all raising basically the same issues, with the only real difference being the amount of loss between them and the diminution in value in particular. If that's the case, then it would usually be sensible to look to issue them together. Where it becomes more difficult is, I've seen this a lot, you have a row of houses, whether it's because one house has been more proactive than the others or whatever it may be, you sometimes have one that's much further along, letter of claim sent earlier, there's already been all the pre-issue back and forth, pretty much ready to claim, and the other neighbours might only have instructed you later. And then the question is, well, do we make claimant one wait for 4 to 6 months while dealing with all of the pre-action issues, getting the expert reports, letter of claim, letter of response, or do we issue now? That can be a difficult one. And honestly, I don't think there's really a right answer. I think all you can do is look at it and think, well, what's the realistic timescale for this? If it's less than 6 months, and that this isn't a hard and fast rule, just a rough and ready approach that I think is sensible. If the other claims are going to be ready within about 6 months, then I think really you should be looking to issue them all together. If the other claims aren't likely to be ready within 6 months, then I think fairly you could say, well, it's unfair of claimant one to have to wait, and then look to issue them separately, whether it's one claimant on their own and then the rest all together, or whether it's even staggering them individual households. It can be a tricky one. Another point about it that you should consider is, has the defendant actually raised a view about it? If a defendant is arguing in pre-action correspondence that if you issue them separately, they'll be looking to have them consolidated and seek costs, you may think, well, it doesn't follow the court would necessarily do that, but you might want to be a bit more careful about issuing them separately, because you're just thinking of protecting your own back later and avoiding having arguments that you might not need to have. At the same time, defendant might be saying that, but sometimes you have concerns that defendant's really just stalling for time. Sometimes you get defendants trying to put treatment in place as quickly as they can, and then you're perhaps a bit cynical, thinking this is really all just done to try and minimise the value of the claim if they can buy enough time before you get to a trial. So you have to be wary of that. But I think it's probably a sensible approach to say, if you can issue them all within 6 months, probably do them together. If not, then issue the ones which are ready to go.
That's really helpful. Thank you. What should you do if a defendant offers to carry out the treatment themselves?
This can be another difficult one, because sometimes defendant offers to carry out treatment. Claimant perhaps doesn't trust them and says, well, I don't think they'll do it properly. Or sometimes you might worry fairly that they're trying to stall for time. Often defendant will say, well, we'll start treatment, but given that we're doing that, nothing should really happen now for, say, 2 years to see what happens. That can be difficult, because that's a very long period of time, and you have to be careful of defendants just trying to kick things into the long grass and avoid any claims for potentially a long period of time. At the same time, it can be very difficult to refuse that, because what you don't want to happen is for the claimant to be criticised later for effectively failing to mitigate their loss by turning down a reasonable offer to treat the knotweed that they should have accepted. You don't want a judge to make that finding and then the value of their claim be reduced. The view I tend to take in cases where this happens is, if a defendant offers to treat claimant's land, then claimant has realistically to accept it, provided the defendant is offering to use a proper PCA registered contractor who can provide an insurance-backed guarantee. Sometimes you have local authorities who use their own workmen to do it, and they'll say, well, they're trained and they may be able to evidence that, that's fine, but often they won't be able to provide the insurance-backed guarantee because they are doing it in-house and they're not able to provide that. That can be a sticking point sometimes in settlement, because the client's thinking, well, I need the guarantee because I'm aware that if someone tries to buy the house, the mortgage lender's going to insist on a guarantee, and without that guarantee, I won't be able to sell the house because somebody won't get a mortgage. So when it comes to that, again, there's no right answer necessarily, but I think you can fairly insist on them using a PCA registered contractor and providing an insurance backed guarantee of 10 years or more. If they refuse to do that, then I think you can fairly refuse the treatment without the risk of being criticised for failing to mitigate. But if they are willing to do that, then I think you need to accept it. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the claim, because you've still got diminution in value. But one thing to think about there is, if a defendant starts treatment and does a good job in 2 to 3 years, then the claim for treatment costs might fall away because the defendant's incurring those costs themselves. So that comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about thinking about the value of the claim. If a defendant offers to treat after you've already issued and served the claim, then if that reduces the value below £10,000, then my view would be you should still be able to recover normal hourly rate costs. If a defendant offers to treat before you issue, and this sometimes happens in the letter of response, you may have to say yes if they're offering to use a proper contractor and for a guarantee to be provided. But that might reduce the value of the claim. And this is something tactical that defendants will do to try and reduce the value of the claim below the small claims limit. Unfortunately, for a claimant, you may say, well, that's unfair, but there's little you can do about that. That's a perfectly valid tactic a defendant can use, however cynically, to bring the value below the small claims limit. If that's the case, then you may then struggle to issue and serve a claim because you won't recover your costs. It may be it doesn't reduce the value below the small claims limit, in which case that's fine, and you can issue and serve in the normal way, but accepting that you're probably not going to recover damages for treatment, just for diminution in value. But either way, it would be difficult to refuse the treatment, provided the defendant is offering to do it properly and offering the guarantee. And you don't want to be in that position of refusing, and then at the end of the trial, judge makes a finding that your client has unreasonably failed to mitigate. So as a rule of thumb, Lauren, I would say if they're offering to do it properly, then you would probably have to accept their offer to treat.
And would you say this happens often, the defendants offering to carry out the treatment? Or do you think it's quite unusual?
It varies. For the big defendants, the local authorities, it varies. I've seen some, and I've acted for some, whose policy is they'll say, we only treat our own land, full stop, in which case this won't happen. I've seen others, and I've acted for others, who will begrudgingly say, well, actually, we will offer to treat your land. Often they'll caveat it by saying it's with no admission of liability, fine, but they will offer to treat. Sometimes that brings the value down below the 10,000, sometimes it doesn't. If it doesn't, then from the claimant's perspective, to be honest, I don't think it really changes the landscape of the case too much. The argument is always mostly about diminution anyway. Treatment is usually less contentious because it's usually a case of getting a quote for treatment and then that's the end of it. So in many ways, it may not change the case too much. Some of the bigger defendants, Network Rail, for example, they often will try and put in place treatment. Often they're treating their own land already. They'll say, well, we have a policy of not treating claimants' land, but they will offer to treat. That's become more and more common. I think after the decision in Williams, I think Network Rail in particular realised that they were in trouble because they've got so much railway land and so much knotweed spreading into people's gardens that I think they've, whether they've taken advice or not, I don't know, but they seem to have taken the view that they might not be able to avoid liability, but what they'll try and do is avoid at least having to pay costs by incurring the cost of treatment to try and reduce the value below the small claims limit. So it is quite common with Network Rail, and that's something you can think about early on when you're looking at the case. If it's a Network Rail case, assume they will probably offer to do that. And when you're doing a rough and ready calculation, have that in mind. So be thinking more about diminution and something for general damages. And is that likely to be enough, rather than spending time running the case and then the treatment costs disappear and then suddenly you're looking at a claim that's only worth, say, £7,000, £8,000 at best, in which case it might not be one to run because you can't justifiably plead it over the small claims limit. So it can be common. If you've got an individual defendant, if it's another homeowner, if it's a commercial premises, but that's just their only premises, they've got knotweed and it spreads, then probably not as common, although it's certainly not unheard of. It's a difficult one. I think it's just something you have to be alive to. You don't have to assume it will happen in every case when you value them, but I think you do have to be alive to it and perhaps warn the client about it so that it doesn't take you by surprise if a defendant does make that kind of offer.
Super, thank you very much. Tom, when do you recommend making Part 36 offers?
It can be good to make one early. Again, thinking about what happens if you get all the way to the end of a trial, it would be good to put that Part 36 offer in place, partly to give the defendant some additional incentive because they don't want to be paying indemnity costs if you've made a well-pitched offer that they don't beat. If you do make a well-pitched offer early, it can give the defendant an incentive to settle. That can be good. Can be good to settle a claim early. The obvious difficulty with that is you don't want to pitch the claim too low. You can make a Part 36 of less than £10,000 and still recover your costs because it hasn't, if you're doing it pre-issue, hasn't been allocated to small claims track, and Part 36 provides for damages plus costs. Depending on your case, it may be that a well-pitched valuation is below 10,000. It may be actually that would make it far too low in which case that's not something you should think about. I usually think it is better to make an offer early. Doesn't have to be multiple offers, but making at least one offer before issuing and serving the claim, if nothing else, just with one eye on indemnity costs at the end of the case. You may take the view that that's not a sensible thing to do, but somewhere along the way, I think it's worthwhile making one. Sometimes, if you have a higher value case, you may take the view that, well, unless and until the defendant puts us at risk, then there's no point making one because the defendant is probably going to lose on liability if you have what you think is a strong case. In those kind of claims, I would say, to be honest, don't make a Part 36. Sit tight until the defendant puts you at risk if you think you have a good case on liability and it's a relatively high value claim. And if you have, say, a house in London, reality is all of those claims are going to be worth hundreds of thousands at least because of the higher property prices. So I would generally say, well, sit tight until defendant puts you at risk. If you think you're at risk on liability, then clearly it would be sensible to make an early Part 36 offer. In terms of pitching it, again, it's always a difficult one. A rough and ready approach would be to do the kind of valuation we spoke about already. Maybe you have by now, if you're thinking before issuing, a surveyor's report, so you're able to do a more accurate valuation. But take that valuation, let's say it's 15,000, just as a rule of thumb. If you think you have a good case, but it's not watertight because nothing ever is, usually taking 60, 65, up to 70% of that is a good sort of approach for making a Part 36. 70% can be good as an opening gambit. You might then have some negotiation back and forth. But as a rough and ready rule, I would say work out what your case is probably worth on best case scenario. Take about 70% of that, and that's usually a good way to pitch a pre-action Part 36 offer to a defendant that puts them at risk. But then if they do accept it, you're not undercompensating the client because getting 70% is still a good outcome if it means they don't have to fight on liability.
Okay, and what happens if the defendant makes a Part 36 offer?
If they do make a Part 36 offer, I suppose really you have to go through that same kind of exercise about thinking about how to value it. One thing I would say first with defendant Part 36 offers is I've seen so many cases where defendant solicitors say in correspondence, we don't think you're entitled to anything for diminution, we're not going to pay you a penny for diminution, but they offer a figure that must include something for diminution, because when you think about it, looking at the figures, there's no other way they get there. And I've had solicitors sometimes think, well, they're not offering anything for diminution, so should we push for more? My advice would be ignore what they say, because they may well say we're not offering anything for diminution, but it's probably included within their figures because they'll be thinking behind the scenes that there's a risk they'll be paying something for that. Ignore what they say about the offer. Just look at the figures and think purely in isolation, are those figures sensible or not? That would be my advice for how to approach it. Then it is a case of analysing the figures and applying a percentage discount for litigation risk when you're thinking, is that an offer that we should be accepting or not? So if your claim you think is worth on a best case scenario 20,000 and the defendant offers you 10,000, let's say, then you're looking at, well, 50% of the overall value. If you think you have a good case on liability, you may think, well, that's too low, we'll make a counter offer of 14,000, 15,000. If you think you might be shakier on liability, if you're not 100% sure on establishing where it encroached from, or you think there might be an issue about particular head of damages, let's say treatment costs or even diminution in value, if you're concerned for whatever reason that you might not get that because of something your client said to you, which the other side doesn't know about, let's say, but you're thinking about trial, then you might want to be thinking, well, actually, I need to apply more of a discount. And suddenly the defendant's offer, which I think is about 50% of the value, is looking more attractive. So I think the answer really is ignore what the defendant says. Look at the figures. Think about your own valuation of the case. Get advice if you're not sure. And then think, should it be accepted? Should it not be accepted? And then if it's not going to be accepted, do you want to make a counter offer or not? If it's within the ballpark, then you may think, well, sensible to make a counteroffer a few thousand higher, in which case I think that is a good idea. If the defendant just makes you a ridiculously low offer, or even doesn't make you a Part 36 offer, but just makes you a cost-inclusive offer of, say, a few thousand pounds, that depending on where you are, may not even cover your disbursements, let alone your own costs and the client's damages, then it may well be not worthwhile making a counteroffer. I think it's really something you just have to look at on a case-by-case basis.
So if you do come to settlement, is there any kind of terms that are important or we should look for?
Well, I suppose the first thing is damages and costs. If it's a Part 36, then that's fine because you know what the damages are and you know that you'll recover your reasonable costs. That's fine. If you do settle not through a Part 36, then you just want to be making sure that your costs are provided for. That may be something that you're dealing with between you and the client rather than with the defendant. That's fine. If defendant makes a cost inclusive offer of 20,000, it's between you and the client really how that's allocated. That's fine, but that's something you need to think about. In terms of other terms, often what will be included in a settlement, and this can be whether it's done by a Tomlin order or not, although often it will end up being done by a Tomlin order, is treatment. Often, if defendant hasn't already started treatment, or they have been treating but it's not been working, then an important term of settlement is that both parties will agree to treat the knotweed. Often the defendant will want that as well from the claimant, because they will be arguing, and I think this is a fair point, that they don't want to treat on their land but claimant doesn't treat and then it re-encroaches onto the defendant's land. And from your perspective advising the claimant, you don't want that either, because then the claimant is suddenly looking at being defendant to a claim later down the road. So I think something that's really important to have covered in the terms of settlement is treatment. So really nailing down, both parties will appoint somebody suitably qualified to carry out the treatment. They will appoint them within a fixed time frame of, say, 3 months or whatever it may be, but not leaving it open-ended, so it could mean years. And for that suitably qualified person to carry out a proper treatment plan with an insurance back guarantee being issued at the end of at least 10 years, and that being a requirement within the agreement, certainly for the defendant, and if they do ask for it from the claimant, we'll find that does need to be included. But I think that's really crucial. Otherwise, you can have damages resolved, you can have costs resolved, but then there can be all sorts of issues later with what happens if defendant doesn't actually treat. You don't want a claimant who gets X amount of damages based on the residual diminution in value after treatment. The claimant themselves treats, but the defendant doesn't treat, and then your claimant is out of pocket, and you may find that you are in difficulty because it was in full and final settlement. Now, you could have arguments about whether there's a separate cause of action, but that's really not something that you want to be having to argue. That's something you want to nail down in the settlement agreement. So I think, Lauren, the one thing I would say, other than being clear on damages and costs, is make sure you have the position on treatment crystal clear so you don't have any arguments later. And I think other than that, I don't think there's anything in general terms that I would say is always really important. It's just a case of case-by-case basis, the standard terms. But that is the one thing I think is very important, is to get the position on treatment clear in the agreement so that everybody knows where they stand.
That's really useful and makes complete sense. Thank you so much, Tom. That now completes episode 5. So join us next for our final podcast series, where we'll be discussing misrepresentation claims and professional negligence. Thank you again, Tom.
Thanks, Lauren. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.